Hi, everybody. It's Friday, and we're really glad you're with us today. This is All of It on WNYC, and I'm Allison Stewart. We're beginning today's show in acknowledgement of the 30th commemoration of World AIDS Day, which is tomorrow, December 1st. According to a report just released by UNICEF, an estimated 3 million children and adolescents are currently living with HIV. 130,000 children and adolescents died from AIDS-related causes in 2017. Kevin Zeeland is the executive director of the AIDS Resource Foundation for Children, based in Newark. He joins us now in studio to talk about the work the foundation has done over the years and how it's changed based on the needs of the community and families, of course, and the advances in care for people with HIV and AIDS. Kevin, welcome to All of It.
I'm grateful to be with you.
And our listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you want to give a call, have you or someone you know been affected by HIV/AIDS? If you want to tell us your story or share a memory of someone, what does World AIDS Day mean to you? You can always call us and join 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Okay, Kevin, tell me about the AIDS Resource Foundation for Children. What's the organization's mission?
Well, the mission of the AIDS Resource Foundation for Children is to help children and families impacted by HIV live healthier lives. It was founded by my parents after they lost a dear friend in 1985, and they decided that they were going to do something to combat this disease, and they were going to do it as a family, helping families. So they opened the first home in the country in 1987, a transitional home for children with AIDS. And at that time, it was a really scary time. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fear and a lot of stigma, and these children were sitting in hospitals with no place to go. They opened the first home and expanded the mission as the needs of the community progressed. They began doing work in Newark and reaching out to the community and really building a sense of community for people living with HIV.
But also in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Was there a specific reason?
Well, the first home was in Elizabeth. We looked all over. I say we. I was 11 years old at the time.
You can be part of the we. That's okay.
But I felt very much a part of the work even back then. We were lucky to find a home. St. Elizabeth's Hospital, it's now Trinitas at the time, there was a gift of a home from someone who had contracted the disease inside the hospital. And so they gifted us a home, and that was our first home. And then we expanded to Jersey City. We opened our second home in Jersey City and our third in Neptune, New Jersey. And today, since we're not seeing as many babies with HIV, thankfully, these homes care for medically fragile children who are part of the DIFAS system. So these are children who are victims of abuse and neglect and have serious medical needs. And those are the children that are cared for in the St. Clair's homes. We continue to work with youth and families all over the state of New Jersey, primarily by providing housing. We're the largest HIV housing provider in the state. So we work with young gay men. We have two transitional residences for young gay men in New Jersey. And one of our newest programs is a statewide HIV housing collaborative, providing emergency housing to people who are HIV positive.
Can I circle back to something you said? You were 11 and you were taking part of this with your parents. Did you understand what was going on? And how did they talk to you about it as a kid?
Well, they were always very open with me, and I was a big part of the every step of the way. I used to volunteer my summers at a summer camp that we ran for families. My first girlfriend is actually an HIV positive client who was part of the foundation. So I all along I would contribute in any way that I mm-hmm. could.
Let's go to a call. We've got Bob on line one who's calling us from Queens. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Allison. You're doing a great job. My question is this. Because of Magic Johnson survive, I think, 17, 20 years later, and he takes drugs, is there a misperception that you could have sexual contact and just simply go to a doctor and get these drugs and you'll never have to have the consequences of sexual activity? That's my basic question.
All right, Bob, thank you so much. It's a good question. Kevin, you want to take it?
It's an excellent question. You know, the drugs have made a tremendous impact on helping extend people's lives. People are living really healthy lives. And we want everyone who's positive to get tested and, get on the medication, because When you get your viral load down to zero, which is to undetectable, which is what the medications can do for you, U equals U. Undetectable means untransmittable, and so we can really stop the spread of HIV if everyone who's positive is in care. And so that's, it's not about, and for those who practice risky behaviors, there are medicines that you can take that will prevent the spread. So it's called pre-exposure prophylaxis. The pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is PrEP for short, and I encourage anyone who practices risky behaviors, look into it because it can save your life.
Always good to have an acronym.
Yes.
We're speaking with Kevin Zeelan, the executive director of the AIDS Resource Foundation for Children. If you would like to join our conversation, our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Let's talk a little bit about how things have changed over time. What's different about treating children who've been diagnosed with HIV or AIDS as opposed to adult patients?
Well, right now, we're not seeing many children being born HIV positive.
You mentioned that, yes.
And so the medications, the antiretrovirals, have been extremely effective at preventing that transmission. And so right now, I think the focus is on young men. Right now, the fear has gone away, and it's out of the news. And so I think people are practicing risky behaviors without fear. And the young generation are taking chances. Adolescents,
yeah.
That's right. And so our programs right now with young gay men, which is one of the areas where we're not seeing the type of reduction that we need to see, we work on more a holistic approach, trying to deal with the trauma that these young men face. You know, a lot of times if you're young and you're gay and you come out, you get put out. And so you have a lot of homeless young men doing what they need to do to survive. And that leads to the spread of HIV. So we have two transitional programs called Project Nest, funded by the state of New Jersey. And these two-year transitional housing programs focus on dealing with the trauma of being thrown out and living on the streets and all of that, and really address the whole person.
Want to take a couple more calls. Let's go to Saul on line two. Hi, Saul. Who do you want to tell us about?
Hi. I'm calling from White Plains, New York. I specialize in working with China. And I've been doing that for the last almost 40 years. And in 1985, when I was a 22-year-old recent graduate, I worked for 6 months as a tour guide, taking groups of Americans to China. And in June of that year, I brought a group in which there was a single traveler, a 35-year-old man from Los Angeles named Oscar Messina, who our second day in China told me he wasn't feeling well and confided that he had leukemia and had been treated for chemotherapy, and thought he might want to start arranging to go home and leave the tour, which I started to do. Within several days, he deteriorated to the point that I had to have him hospitalized in Beijing and told the doctors there about his leukemia. I interpreted for him. He then died within a day, arriving in the hospital, and only after his death did the Chinese health authorities learn that actually he died of AIDS. And it was significant because up until that point, China, the largest country in the world, had paid no attention to the disease. And they announced the death of this tourist as the very first recorded AIDS death in China. And immediately, in 1985, the government and health authorities started what has become since very large program and attention to the disease in China, including screening of blood sources coming domestically as well as from overseas. I blogged about this a few years ago, and each year on World AIDS Day, I republish my blog on the Huffington Post, because this guy was not a famous guy. He was a 35-year-old guy who probably knew his life was ending and wanted to have one last hurrah and have an exotic trip. His name was Oscar Messina. What he didn't know in his very quiet death in Beijing was that he single-handedly moved the largest country in the world to pay attention to the disease.
Saul, thank you so much for sharing your story. We really appreciate it. Let's go to Rose on line three. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
And welcome to NYC. I don't think I've called since you've been here.
Well, thank you very much.
So I wanted to just mention that Clara Hale from Hale House in Harlem, the charity is no longer operational, but that she had taken in a lot of, abandoned children is how some people might describe it. A lot of children and families who were affected by HIV. And she did really phenomenal work. The house was recently sold, but there's a statue of her in the front yard with a child, hugging a child. And I'm just wondering, curious about what's going to happen to that now that there are new owners. But, you know, I've been hearing reports that AIDS is actually on the rise among people above the age of 50. And I'm wondering what kind of work is, you know, being done in that regard. I'm in New Jersey often and Newark often, and the rates of poverty there are, you know, for all the growth that the city is said to be experiencing and the gentrification, the rate of poverty there is quite severe.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering what kind of work the group plans to do there, the organization plans to do there.
Thanks, Rose.
Thanks.
Yeah, so we are with our statewide HIV Housing Collaborative. We are operating a homeless hotline that folks can call, and through that, we've had since we started a little bit over a year ago, we've had over 500 folks calling in need of housing, and a large amount of those folks are seniors or elderly. Part of those are folks who've lived with the disease for quite some time, but I imagine that The new diagnoses are probably because it's out of the news and people don't talk about it enough. Mm. I think the younger generation is uneducated about HIV, and the older generation hasn't really sunk in that it's something we need to be vigilant about, and we need to continue to take protective measures.
Is there still stigma?
Oh, there's tremendous stigma.
With all the education available?
You know, I'm blown away every time I hear someone who just hasn't been educated, has been, you know, living in a bubble. I feel like over the past 15 years or past 10 years, we've regressed tremendously in our public awareness. And it's really sad. It's really sad. We need to embrace everyone for who they are and be open about it. And the stigma is only hurting our efforts to get to zero new transmissions.
We have obviously a very smart and sophisticated audience, and we still had questions. So where would you point someone who maybe didn't call because they didn't want to ask their question and thought it might be too basic? Where would you point someone who wants to educate or re-educate themselves about HIV and AIDS?
Sure. I mean, there's the internet is a wonderful
resource. Well, good. Where on the internet? We have to be careful about that.
Yeah, no. I mean, CDC is really a wonderful resource. And New Jersey Department of Health has a wonderful website as well. And there's some great facts up there. And I encourage everyone to just do some research and find out, because HIV is not something we need to fear. We really don't need to fear HIV, but if we're practicing risky behaviors, we need to educate ourselves and protect ourselves.
Kevin Zeelan is the executive director of the AIDS Resource Foundation for Children. Thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
As we continue our discussion ahead of World AIDS Day, we're joined by two very special guests. Tobin Lowe is the co-host and co-managing editor of the WNYC Studios podcast, Nancy. And David Gabel is...
Gabel,
you know, David, it's so funny. I've been here for about 3 months. I know how to get to three places. The studio, my office, four, the ladies' room and coffee. So we haven't officially met. Hello,
nice to
David.
Meet
nice
you.
To meet you.
I've seen you in the hall.
I've heard your beautiful voice around the edges. David does administrative work for two of our biggest shows, Radiolab and The Takeaway. So David, you approached Tobin because you wanted to have, you thought it was important to have an intergenerational conversation about this issue. Why did you think it was important? And can you share with people, our listeners, folks who haven't heard this podcast episode, why it was important to you personally?
Well, it was really based on a New York Times article that I read that mentioned patient zero. And I just sat there and thought, I have no idea if a young person even knows what that's referring to. Mm-hmm. It's like, is my common knowledge even being passed on in any way? And I was really curious because I'd not talked to anyone in their 20s who was HIV positive, and I didn't know what their experience was. And I was really interested.
And it's interesting that there isn't this history Tobin, do you know why that is? Why that hasn't been shared?
I think it's, well, it's exactly what David said about wanting to reach out. And I think that's the key. You know, for queer people, we have to seek out intergenerational connections because it's not necessarily built into our family. It's not necessarily built into, you know, just walking down the street. It's a thing that you have to go in search of.
And David, would you share your personal story?
Oh, I tested positive in 1987. The big love of my life was sick with AIDS at that point. Mm-hmm. And officially, we'd broken up, but we had daily contacts, the breakup that never broke up. But he said, you have to get tested. And I had thought about it. He goes, no, you need to get tested now. You need to know. And truth be told, I expected to be positive. Yeah. I wasn't surprised at all. I know that can be a really devastating moment for some people when they get tested. And I would have been shocked if I wasn't.
Because you were in, I mean, I was in New York in the 80s.
Yeah, I was really sexually active. I was out there. And if I hadn't been, it would have been a miracle.
What did you, when you realized you tested positive, what did you feel? What did you think at that moment?
I actually was remarkably calm. I was with my doctor, and I said, I remember sitting there. We were looking at thrush, which was like a little white thing under your tongue that you get. And it kind of sunk in, and I turned to him, and I said, should I be scared? And he went, no, just informed. And that phrase has gotten me through everything. And I have said that to many young people.
Is that on a t-shirt somewhere? Because it needs to be.
I mean, it changed everything for me, Allison.
That's amazing.
And I had watched my big love of my life, Stephen, seek medical help that would give him the answer he wanted to hear. He was jumping from doctor to doctor, and he was in denial. And I thought that the only thing I'm going to do and make a promise to myself is I'm not going to do that. I am not going to not go to the doctor. I'm not going to go to a doctor who tells me what I want to know or what, you know, tells me I want to know the truth. And this means I go to the doctor every week, so be it. Because I watched him avoid it. And then I watched him die.
Tobin, so you're in your early 30s. You talk to David. You guys have this conversation. How did you, let me put your managing editor hat on.
Sure.
How did you decide you wanted to tackle this for your podcast?
Well, I think David originally came to us, and the idea originally was more like, I just want to hear from somebody who's younger, who may be HIV positive. And then the idea really came out of, well, we could do that story, but it would be perhaps even more interesting to have David in the studio to talk to that person and to see what was common in their experience, what was different about their experiences as both HIV positive men. So we got him in the studio with a man named Dominique, who's in his early 30s and at the time was working with Gay Men's Health Crisis. And they just had this beautiful conversation about, you know, what overlapped in their experiences.
We have a little bit of that. Let's play it so our listeners can check it out.
When you hear someone my age talk about the 80s or what it was like or everybody was dying, what do you think?
We're still dying. It's just that it's different. I think a lot of, I see a lot of my young black youth dying still to this day. Now it changed. The communities that are dying changed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not talked about as often, but it's still around. AIDS crisis is still around.
How many friends of yours have you lost?
So many. I've lost so many people.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. People say, you know, it's not the 80s I'm worth. People not dying from it. Yes, they are. They're still dying from it. They're still being affected from it. I know black men are getting affected, especially the black youth.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting affected. And we're still dying, right? A lot of the stigma.
It's not cured.
No, it's not cured.
So, David, you walked into this. The whole thing began because you wanted to know more and you wanted to learn more. So what did you learn? What did you take away from this
conversation? I'm sorry to say that it isn't what I thought I would learn. There is still stigma. He had a lot of stigma from his friends and his community. And I was really hoping that he'd be able to test positive and he'd be able to get the help he wanted. Or maybe, really, he'd be able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be able to talk to his family or his friends. And he couldn't. Necessarily. I was really surprised at that. You know, I'm a older white man and it's gotten better for us. And he opened my eyes to what I suspected is that there are other communities being hit really, really hard and the communication and the education isn't necessarily out there, nor is the support. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised that he had to keep it from his family for so long.
That is the downside of things getting better in a way for one group, right?
One group. It's not gone.
Because I can remember in the 80s, I mean, you could not open a newspaper. People used to actually open newspapers. You could not open a magazine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really everywhere. It was a sense of a public health issue.
It was on the street, Allison. I mean, you saw it. You could see someone. You there was a look, and you knew it. And it was walking around among you.
Yeah. Do you agree with what David's assessment?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things
you're a young person.
Well, I think one of the things we really did want to focus on in the episode, which came out very organically, is who the AIDS crisis is affecting has shifted, and to sort of address, you know, that two men of different experiences can have commonalities in what they experience and the stigma that they face, but maybe how the resources are shifting and, you know, who's there to help may not be shifting in the same way.
Yeah, he's got so much medical help that wasn't available to me or my friends. And I loved that the episode proved to start conversations. People reached out to me on Facebook. People came up to me here at the station and they had something to say. It made the conversation happen again, which I thought was crucial because there's this big gap if the history doesn't get passed on. It's gone, and then we haven't gotten ahead.
Well, you guys did it. You marked it. You made it. There's a record of this conversation, so it will go forward, right? The rest of the Nancy audience, we know everybody around here wants to have conversations about these kind of things. The folks who listen to the podcast, what's the response?
The response was incredible. I mean, I think that we constantly hear from our listeners that they want this kind of intergenerational conversation to be happening. We want to learn from our queer elders. Mm-hmm. And so I think people were just hugely grateful to hear it talked about in this very authentic way.
It's a great episode, everyone. You should take a listen to it. It's really worth your time. Thank you, David. And thank you, Tobin, for coming in and sharing your story and your reporting and just having a nice conversation.
Thanks for bringing it up. Thanks for having us.
When All That Returns, we'll talk to two creators behind a performance piece at BAM called The White Album, a celebration and interpretation of Joan Didion's essay of the same name. This is All of It on WNYC. Yeah. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. A new theatrical production at BAM is based on Joan Didion's book of essays, The White Album. She was part of this new journalism wave, and Didion wrote about events taking place between 1968 and 1978, where she reveals her role not just as witness of quickly changing times, but also as a participant. The essays depict Didion's encounters with emerging cultural titans, including hanging with Jim Morrison in The Doors during a recording session, or engaging with members of the Black Panthers, including Huey Newton and Eldred Cleaver, who Didion spoke with in his San Francisco apartment. Artist Lars Jahn brings Didion's essays to the stage with actor Mia Baron reciting, interpreting Didion's essays in their entirety throughout. The White Album is currently playing at BAM through December 1st, and we're thrilled to have Lars and Mia in studio. Thanks for coming down, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
So, Lars, you first read this piece as a teenager.
Yeah.
But you've returned to it repeatedly. Why?
Well, the first sentence, we tell ourselves stories in order to live, is something you can latch onto as a 16-year-old. And I was, a burgeoning artist. And I thought, okay, I can make – it seemed chaotic even then. And I think I had streaks of angst and nihilism flowing through my veins as a teenager might. But her version of the articulation of some of those feelings, of the kind of internal crisis as it resonates with what looks like the chaotic landscape around you macroscopically, was so articulate and really sort of permeated me in a way that I just never forgot. So whenever I was feeling, I think, lost as to what the next move might be or how, I'm not sure how to create meaning. How do I create meaning? I would go back to her articulation of that struggle.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, and I found her articulation of how hard it is to create meaning, like the most meaningful story.
And did that, I'm interested, as someone who read it over the course of your maturation, did it feel different or did it mean different things to you along the way?
Yeah, of course, right? Like it's, for example, the first sentence, again, the first, when I looked at it, like sort of first blush, it was about storytelling and crafting something and putting pieces together. And though that's a struggle, there's the desire to put the puzzle pieces together and to see a picture. And as I got older, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. Increasingly meant to me, we create delusions in order to get by.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mia, how familiar were you with Didion's work?
I grew up, my mother was a writer, and her books were all over our house, so mm-hmm. I always sort of felt like she was part of the family in a way, and I had a glancing knowledge of her work, but I didn't have the intimate relation with it that Lars did. But when he had this idea of theatricalizing this essay, I immediately felt that it was a right and brilliant and possible thing to do, because it's an inherently theatrical essay. Her voice, her articulation of that struggle is inherently active and alive. And I also immediately felt a sense of deep attachment and familiarity with the world of her writing, and a mm-hmm. sense that that is something that I would be afraid of tackling, but also I could tackle. So yes, I was extremely excited by that idea.
Is this something, Lars, that you've been thinking about for a long time and you thought, I will wait till 2018, till the 50th the anniversary, or did it just happen organically that way?
I'm not that strategic. Yeah. No, not at all. I have been thinking about it for a while, but all of a sudden pieces started falling into place where, I mean, my relationship with Mia, we're partners, and we've never collaborated before, but she comes from working on complex new American writing, and I come from a more experimental visual landscape of theater. So I don't think I ever quite knew. I knew I wanted to do something with the piece, but I didn't quite know how to do that. And I think Joe Melillo at BAM, this is his last season at BAM, as the curator, the producer of the Next Wave Festival, said, you know, what do you want to do, a few years ago? And I said, I would love to do the White Album. And I've been trying tentatively to try to get the rights, mm-hmm. which for me was writing a couple emails that went unanswered for years.
That was my next question. How does one do that?
From that conversation with Joe, we ramped up our efforts, and BAM started helping, and Center Theater Group in Los Angeles started helping, and then Mia is very connected in the theater community here, and eventually got in touch with a friend, Griffin Dunn, Joan's nephew,
mm-hmm.
and I'd say within a few hours of actually reaching him, we got the green light.
It was crazy, because Lars had tried a little bit, and as soon as he talked to me about the project, we began trying, and we did many different ridiculous things to try to contact Joan Didion. We sent her typewritten letters and
using the White Album record dust jacket.
Yeah, we
oh,
as,
wow.
the, as the envelope.
You went all.
we went all out, but we couldn't get a response. We didn't get a no. We just couldn't get a response, and so. We were sort of nearing the end. We didn't know how we were going to get the rights, and we were close to giving up. And then my friend suggested we get in touch with Griffin Dunn, and I realized I had met him a little bit in years past, and he immediately was so kind and said, oh, it sounds great idea. And he said, I'll talk to her. And then within 3 hours that afternoon, we got a call from her agent saying, you got the go-ahead. So it was crazy after all that time to get an immediate... Yes.
It's wonderful, though.
It was thrilling.
That's great. We're speaking with Lars Jahn and Mia Baron about the White Album, which is currently on at BAM through tomorrow. We're talking about Joan Didion's work, The White Album. It's interesting that you said that you've been thinking about this for years, because when you do think about what's going on right now in the world, and then you think about 1968 and how tumultuous these 2 years are, was it fate intervening, saying this piece needs to happen now?
Yeah, we keep thinking about 2068 too, actually, so that we're kind of projecting forward and thinking 2068 somehow feels more like the distant future than 1968 feels like the distant past. And some of the things we're having these open forum conversations after the performances, mm-hmm. and realizing we're having a couple different generations talk to each other. We have an inner audience in the performance which experiences a different track of the show, and it's mostly composed of younger people, mostly in their 20s, and there's a conversation between a lot of people who are a more traditional theater-going audience, often sometimes people who maybe lived through the 60s mm-hmm. themselves. And so hearing their recollections of the time, their experience of the work in conversation with people who've only learned about the 60s through the kind of these recurrences. For example, you can see there are echoes of the Black Panthers and Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. Totally different movements, but police brutality, for example, is at the core of sort of both of their grievances. Mm-hmm. And very different approaches. So it's interesting to see those threads of organizing and concern and also trauma continue in our culture. And there's something that's very dark and cyclical about that. And it's and yet always in our conversations, people are able to point to other places where it feels like the culture has moved, quote unquote, forward, mm-hmm. whatever that means. So I'm not sure that it's two steps forward, one step back. I don't know that there is a thing that's called progress, but the cycles are complicated. And where we feel where we are right now, I'm hopeful that, for example, one of the things that we focus on in the piece is this student protest at San Francisco State, which at the time was the largest student protest in American history on a college campus. And I feel those movements burgeoning in our country. I don't know that they've caught on like wildfire mm-hmm. in the culture more broadly as they did in the late 60s. So like this, we coming from California, I was going to make use a metaphor for sort of spark and kindling yeah. and
maybe
wildfire.
Not the best right now.
Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
Not the best.
Yeah,
it's. I read somewhere that there are a dozen collaborators involved in this show.
Yeah, more.
Fill us in on all the different elements that people will see.
Yeah, it's a Baroque visual piece. A couple lighting designers. There's a choreographer, Stephanie Zalatel, who's a really exciting new voice in California. Amazing vocalist, actress named Sharon Udo from Columbus, Ohio, who we picked up in August this year. So we've been kind of accruing collaborators in different cities where we've done residencies over time. And sound designer, amazing soundscape with original compositions. There's a couple things that are spoilers that I don't get into,
okay.
go into, but there are some complex special effects and costuming magic as well.
Mia, how did you approach this? How did you, as an actor?
Terror and perseverance, I guess. I mean, it was a strange task because unlike a regular play under the auspices of a theater where you rehearse sort of straight through for 5 weeks and put it up, this was our own project. It wasn't under any one person's guidance. So we had to raise money, do a residency for a few weeks, then have 5 months off, and then, you know, work on it again. So there was no continuity. It was a jagged process necessitated by just how complicated it was to build. And I had to learn this massive text. And obviously, just knowing the lines is the sort of baseline of what an actor does. It's not the actual work. And yet that part of the work was so unusually massive. I just spent a lot of time listening. I recorded it and just listened to it all the time. And we live in California right now, so I'm always in my car. I just, you know, spent all the time listening to my own voice, which starts to make one crazy. But and then Lars and I would come together for residencies and start to do research and explore. And he would give me some guidance and framework. And then I would really just go off on my own and think about what the shape of it is and just... The gestational period actually wound up being extremely helpful because the ideas are so complex and beautiful and the language is so dense, it has to be absorbed over time. You can't just kind of cram it and make a decision and go for it. You have to know it in your bones in a way. And that has only come recently, I would say. And we've been living with the essay for a few years. But the more I live inside it, the more I love and appreciate her mind and the vastness of it and the specificity of her inner life.
I'm curious, as an actor, when you approached it, did you approach it as a recitation? Is it a performance? Are you being Joan Didion?
I'm very anti-recitation. In fact, somehow, sometimes when the press came out, certain press people would say, this actress recites the essay, and it would make me crazy because I...
Cringy?
Yeah, because I, you know, it can't be a recitation. It's not a concert. It's a live performance, and in order for the performance to work, apart from all the incredible visual and structural things that Lars has done to theatricalize this and to make it vivid and alive, it has to sound like I am thinking of it in the moment. Otherwise, it will be dead, stiff. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's a performance, and I am Joan Didion only in the sense that I am the character that she's created through her voice, but I'm not mimicking her because that would be a lost cause. Mm-hmm. And not really what anyone needs to see anyway. I mean, there's plenty of wonderful footage of her. So I watched her a little, some footage, but then I tried to just allow myself to use the text as the guide, the way I would as if I were an actor in a more traditional play, and create a sense of character from that. And I think that's what one does with writing. You know, mm-hmm. she it is her, and it is also. It is also a structured creation. You know, it's many shards of her, many parts of her that come forward through her voice, but it's not an exact replica.
Yeah, the essay is so unusual in that it's written, it's tagged 1968 to 78. So clearly she wrote, and it's in 15 sections, and she was clearly a slightly different person, right, mm-hmm. as we all are over the course of a decade, probably. And I think she retained that in the completed piece. You can feel her shifting in different ways from being a journalist and being an observer to a person who's actually who's experiencing attacks of nausea and vertigo, and her ability to sort of be a fly on the wall versus sort of be at the center of the center stage is something that's remarkable about this particular essay. And you mentioned new journalism and the sort of the tradition of Hunter S. Thompson and Norman Mailer, and sort of she's the most interesting. Like, she's up there with Huey Newton, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, but Joan Didion's the most interesting character in that essay.
Hmm. The name of the piece is The White Album. It's playing at the Brooklyn Academy of Music through this Saturday, December 1st. Lars Jenn and Mia Baron, thank you so much for joining us on all of it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
After the break, we'll be back with another installment of our petition series. This time it's a crowdsourced effort to help combat issues of sexual and physical violence by and against students in the NCAA. This is all of it. Stay with us. This is all of it on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Regular listeners of the show know I'm obsessed with online petitions. The idea that someone takes time out of his, her, their life to try to change something for the better is an idea I think we can all get behind. That's not to say we endorse or support any particular petition, but I think, say, we can endorse civic engagement. Today's petition is about violence in college sports. We want to note to our listeners that this discussion will include topics of sexual assault and rape. Here's a little context. In October of this year, the NCAA finally completed its investigation into the sexual assault scandal at Baylor's athletic department, 2 years after that story broke. The NCAA cited Baylor with one of its most serious charges, saying that there was, quote, lack of institutional control there. Now the school's waiting to see if the NCAA decides to shut down the college football program entirely. While this is an important step for the NCAA, advocates for sexual assault victims say the organization does not go far enough. For our petition segment this week, we've invited Cody McDavis on the show. He's a former Division I athlete and now a UCLA law student and managing editor of the UCLA Law Review. And he created a petition on change.org about a month ago. He wrote, quote, I'm calling on the Power Five conference commissioners, the most influential conference in the NCAA, to immediately ban student athletes with a history of violence. So far, as of 8 a.m. this morning Eastern Standard Time, 8,636 people signed the petition with a 10,000-signature goal. It struck a chord with many people. Cynthia Eggert, Ph.D., commented after she signed the petition. She said, I taught for 2 decades at Seton Hall, Rutgers, Dominican College, and several other schools. I spent way too much time counseling some of my female students after they were raped. We need to respond far more forcefully than we have in the past, when all two rape victims are shamed and even bribed into silence. Cody's petition linked to another petition that was created 2 years ago asking the NCAA to ban violent athletes. That petition has received over 190,000 signatures. It was created by Darius Adams, whose mother, Brenda Tracy, was raped by college athletes years ago, something she divulged to her son once he was old enough to understand. She now runs a nonprofit, Set the Expectation, dedicated to combating sexual and physical violence in college athletics. We are happy to welcome Cody and Brenda to the show today. We should say we reached out to the NCAA, as well as the Power Five Conference Commissioners for comment. We did not hear back in time for the show. Cody and Brenda, welcome to All of It.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Sure, Cody, we're going to start with you. Brenda, hang out for a minute. Cody, sure. Why did you start this petition? What made you decide to go ahead and do this? You're a busy guy. You're in law school.
Yeah, that's very true. So I guess it's similar to Brenda's going to get to this, but Brenda, she told her son Darius when he was old enough about her experience, and that is what got him to create that petition that got over 190,000 signatures. For me, I had family members who, when I was old enough, told me about their experiences, and they were, I think sexual assault is traumatizing to different people in different ways. They were traumatizing to those that I care about and love. And I was old enough to understand, but not old enough to do anything about it. That stuck with me. I'll never forget the day that I was told about that. I got to college. I got involved with NCAA leadership at a very, very early in college as a Division I athlete at the same time. And that was my opportunity. That was my opportunity to make the change that I really wanted to see, to act on those feelings that I've had for such a long time. About the transgressions that had happened to people that I love. And from there, I met Brenda, and here we are today. That's kind of the impetus for all of this. Mm-hmm. I've worked with the It's On Us campaign, with the White House and the NCAA to kind of get this going. And here we are today with this petition to finally, hopefully, see some results.
What is your goal with this petition? What do you want to see happen? Who do you want to see take action?
I want to see the leaders of college athletics. I want them to take a stand and say that, look, we see what's happening at Baylor. We see what's happening at Penn State, Tennessee, Florida State, Oregon State with Brenda several decades ago. I want them to see these things that are happening and not just make, you know, these small steps and just be in action on the backside. I want them to get in front of this and make some change and take one stand once and for all. And say that we're not going to stand for this anymore. We're not going to stand sideline and just continue to let this happen because we don't want to deal with the PR nightmare. That is what's going on right now. It seems like the PR nightmare that comes out of Baylor is what they're responding to, but not the issues that is affecting the lives of people everywhere. All of our campuses, our college campuses. This is a real issue, and what I want is the leaders of our college campuses to take a stand.
You mentioned that you were on these NCAA committees. You were on the committee to end rape on campus. What went on with that committee? Was it satisfying?
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were making a difference?
It's satisfying to start, but at the end, I'd say the exact opposite. It actually kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth. So Brenda and I sat on what was called the Commission to Combat Campus Sexual Violence. It was started by the NCAA, and in large part, almost entirely because of Brenda's son's original petition that got over 190,000 signatures. That started this commission. For 2 years, we sat on that, and both Brenda and I advocated for individual accountability of student-athletes that have or do commit acts of violence or sexual violence or any kind of that sort to have accountability for that. That's what we were asking for. In August of this year, that commission was disbanded by the Board of Governors, and they said, can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just commenting.
Yeah, and what they said was that we are going to keep an eye on this issue, but we're not going to take any official action when it comes to individual accountability. And that, to me, was just a slap in the face. Brenda and I both flew out to Indianapolis to their headquarters for this commission for 2 years. Brenda is a woman that has had these experiences and is out there traveling to university to university, hundreds of thousands of air miles, so that she can go talk about this message. And after 2 years of our time, we are getting nothing. This, to me, and to many people that I speak about, is common sense reform. We're just asking you to adopt a rule that says we will not allow student athletes to take the national stage on television in front of thousands of people. We are not going to allow you to take that stage to have that privilege if you are going to commit these actions against other people, period. There are very few people that would say that that's a radical stance. And I think that after 2 years, that is a change that should be adopted immediately.
Brenna, let's bring you into this conversation. At what point did you realize that you wanted to talk to your son about what had happened to you?
Oh, well, I kind of was forced to talk to my son, Darius. We had, as a survivor of a gang rape, I had a lot of issues. And I raised my sons. They were very little when I got gang raped. And I was dealing with depression, PTSD. I was suicidal. I would say I was not the best mother. I was not the mother they deserved. They were dealing with a mom who was really traumatized. And because of that, my son had some issues. And so at one point in his life, I just felt like I was, either my son was going to end up dead or in jail. And I felt like I had to tell him who I was, why I was the way that I was, and what had happened to me. And I was really afraid that I was going to lose him in that moment when I told him, because I thought that he would be so disgusted and so ashamed of me when he found out that I was gang raped. But I told him, and it was this weird thing for me, because when I told him through tears and, you know, I'm sorry, please don't be ashamed of me, he just looked at me and said, Mom, why would I ever be ashamed of you? You did nothing wrong. And that really resonated with me. But then he also said to me, so you mean all these years it wasn't my fault? He blamed himself for the way that I was, my depression and all these other things. And so that was a real turning point for us in that moment. And my son then at that moment looked at me as someone who just had been struggling and was working really hard to be a single mom and get through nursing school and raise him and his brother. So that was why I first told him.
At what point did you realize that you could turn your trauma into activism?
You know, it kind of just happened. When I first came forward with my story, I thought that it would just kind of be in the news for like 15 minutes and I'd go back to my nursing career. But what happened was there was an issue with the statute of limitations. I found out that there was a cover-up with my gang rape. Everybody knew that these men had done this, but the DA had lied to me and said I didn't have a good case when they had taped confessions. So the statute of limitations to prosecute had ran out. And so everybody was kind of like, why do we only have a 6-year statute of limitations in Oregon? And so that was the first thing I did, is I went to my legislators and I changed the statute of limitations. And then I kind of started speaking and getting involved in the sports arena and just started really realizing all the loopholes and all the problems. Like, all of these things that happened to me 20 years ago are still happening today. Hmm. And I was like, I need to use my story to change this. This cannot keep happening. There are so many Brenda Tracys all across this country, and nothing has changed. It infuriated me when I saw the Baylor scandal, because I was like, my rape happened almost 20 years ago, and this is still happening? Are you kidding me? We've changed nothing. We've made no advancement, no progress. So I have this story, and I want to use it. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm using my pain and my story to help shed light on this and help make change.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Set the Expectation campaign?
Sure. So Set the Expectation is basically, I'm just asking college administrators and coaches to set the expectation that sexual assault and physical violence are never okay. I'm asking them to stand in the room and set boundaries, mostly with coaches and our athletes. There are some coaches that say playing sports is a privilege, not a right. And if you harm someone, domestic violence, sexual assault, you don't play for me. And there's other coaches that are harboring violent athletes. They're recruiting them. I mean, if you look at Reuben Foster in the news right now, the Redskins actively recruited a man arrested for domestic violence. So this is an issue in high school, college, pro sports. And so I'm asking people to set the expectation that sexual assault and physical violence are never okay. Playing sports is a privilege, not a right.
And Cody, I'm going to get to you for the last question. With these two petitions, Brenda's was aimed at the NCAA, yours is the NCAA Conference Commissioners. Have you heard from either group as a result of this petition?
No. We've heard from the NCAA through those meetings, but if you want me to tell you what the NCAA's response was, it was, we see you, but we're not going to make any changes. We see what happened to Brenda, you know, 20 years ago, and it's happening again today via Baylor, via many other universities, and we're not going to make any changes. That was the response. In response to mine now, nothing. I mean, you guys have reached out for comment. These people know me. I've been involved with NCAA leadership. I have met each of the commissioners of these conferences personally, and I have not heard from any of them. The hope is that we're going to get individuals to continue to sign this petition so that we can get it and we can get that momentum so we can get individuals to get behind us and say, look, we as a society stand on this side of the line. You can get on this side of the line or you can get lost because this needs to change.
We've been speaking with Cody McDavis, a UCLA law student who started a petition to ban violent athletes from sports, and Brenda Tracy runs a nonprofit, Set the Expectation. If you go to our Twitter account, you can check out both of their petitions. Cody and Brenda, thank you so much for sharing your stories.
Thanks so much for having us.
You've been listening to all of it on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll see you after the news. Yeah.